I want you to consider with me this list here that sums up the relationship characteristics that we've seen between Father, Son, and Spirit. Now, the bulk of this gospel has focused on the relationship of whom? Regarding deity. Son and the Father. But in those latter chapters, we begin to see that Jesus says, I'm going away. However, what? We'll send the Spirit. The Spirit's coming. And when you begin to learn about the Spirit, His nature, His character, His relationship to the Father, His relationship to the Son, we see that it's that this relationship is characterized by the same thing. So these are some of the characteristics. There's an equality between Father, Son, and Spirit. However, just because there's equality doesn't mean that one will not submit to the other. And so we've seen mutual support, that they help one another in their work or their task. They work in unison. They glorify one another. They defer to one another. The Son came to do the will of the Father. The Spirit would take of what was the Son's and declare it. He would speak on the Son's authority. And so there they are deferring to one another. You have this mutual love, and you have a generosity that they share with one another. When you read the letters of the New Testament that are written to tell us how to live as followers of Christ, does that list look familiar? That's how we are to interact with each other. It's the same relationship. So one way to look at the Gospel of John is that it's a modeling of how to have relationships. And so we understand, it's just a given, though we've stated it many times, that the relationship we have with the Father and we have with each other is different than the relationship that the Spirit and the Son have and the Son and the Father have. And that's on a different level entirely. But there are similarities in that we are to have this kind of mutual support. There is this deference we're to have one another, generosity, mutual love, unity, things such as that. So, availability for the other. Yeah, being at one another's disposal. I thought there was room for another one there. Okay. All right, well, let's look here at chapter 18. We're going to look at highlights of 18, 19, and even 20. And look with me to verses 3 to 8. And it's interesting that we're looking at this now because the last three sermons have focused on the narrative, the combined narratives of the Gospels of the arrest, trials, crucifixion, and resurrection of Jesus. So this narrative, including what John contributes to that narrative, is fresh on our minds. And so we backtrack a little bit to look at this from the perspective of what this says in light of Jesus being God the Son. When you really think about, this is the Son of God. This is the Word of God. This is the only one like the Father who's experiencing these things. So this is the garden arrest. Let's look at this. Look at verses 3 to 8. Rick, can you read those verses, John 18, 3 to 8?
Judas then, having received the Roman cohort and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that were coming upon him, went forth and said to them, Whom do you seek? They answered him, Jesus the Nazarene. He said to them, I am he. And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with them. But therefore he said to them, I am he. They drew back and fell to the ground. Again, therefore he asked them, Whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus the Nazarene. Jesus answered, I told you that I am he. If therefore you seek me, let these go their way.
All right. Now, this is this arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane is covered by all four Gospels. There are some unique things that John adds, and specifically what he adds is this interaction that happens at the onset of the arrival of the soldiers and the leaders that are coming to get Jesus. And that's when he asks, Who do you seek? And they say, Jesus of Nazareth. And he says, I am he. Now, this is also a verbal device that Jesus uses that John's gospel in particular highlights. I am. So what have we seen so far in the Gospel of John? Jesus has said that I am what?
The light.
I'm the light.
The way.
I am the way.
Truth.
I'm truth.
Bread of life.
I am the bread of life. I'm the good shepherd. I am the door of the sheepfold. However, when you look at the reaction of this group that come to arrest him, and this is a strongly Jewish contingency, okay, that's come to arrest him. They may have had some aid by Roman soldiers, because Roman soldiers were used like a police force in most occasions. How do they react when he says, I'm he?
They fell down.
They fell back. They're taken back by this. And this is a unusual reaction that they have. And the best explanation that I've seen for it is that the way Jesus phrased this is that he is phrasing this like the term Yahweh in the Hebrew, in the Old Testament. That's the name of God given to Moses there in Exodus 23. From which we get our word Jehovah and Lord in most translations. Either your translation translates Yahweh as Lord or Jehovah. It's the name of God. And it means self-existent one. None of us are self-existent. We're created and we're reproduced. We're created by design. God didn't create us at the beginning. He came along a lot later. But we are a creation of God in that God created the reproduction process of human beings, and we're a product of that, so we're a product of God's creation. And so we're not self-existent. We had a beginning, and we had the divine force, God, that created us. But God is self-existent. He didn't have a beginning. He didn't have a maker. He was not reproduced. Nothing like that. He is self-existent. And so that's what the term means. And it took them back. And so this is most likely on purpose. He is saying this on purpose to, you know, declare once again, as we see in John's gospel, that it's a claim of deity. Yeah, Rick.
Don't you think there's a miraculous demonstration of power here? That it almost looks as if they were knocked to the ground.
I don't know. I mean, that's possible. I am he. English Standard says they drew back and fell to the ground. They drew back. It's connecting they to the action.
They actually fell. Makes it,
I'd have to look at the construction of the original language. English Standard. What's the New King James? I'm sorry. The New American say there.
Same thing.
They drew back and fell to the ground. So if it says he knocked them back, that maybe different. But I have to look at that. I mean, there might be something to that. But that right there is a declaration. And I want you to consider, in light of what we know about his nature and his character, his origin, everything about him that we've seen in the Gospel of John, what happens over the next couple of pages is quite, well, in one way we could say that it's ironic, although that doesn't do it justice. In a way, you could say it's a paradox, but that really doesn't do it justice either. And here's what I'm getting at. Look at verses 18, chapter 18, verse 12. When they took Jesus, when they arrested him, what does verse 12 say they did? They bound him. And then if you look down in verse 24, he first goes to Annas, who was like the elder statesman among the leaders of the Jews, who was the former high priest. And then he's taken to Caiaphas, who is the acting high priest, who oversees the actual Sanhedrin council prosecution of Jesus. In verse 24, when they lead him to Caiaphas, what did they do? They bound him. Now, what's sort of crazy? I guess that's the word we'll use. What's crazy about that they bound him? Who is this?
Well, on top of that, they sent a Roman cohort to Jesus and 12 disciples.
Right.
I mean, that's supposed to be 600 men, whether it is or not.
Right.
So they're afraid of it.
They are afraid of him. They're afraid of some kind of insurrection resistance, yeah. And the fact that Jesus is standing there bound, probably bound with rope. Who is this, according to John 1? It's God. Humans have bound God in human flesh. That it's a silly kind of picture in a way. That humans could do that. Of course, the only reason why they're able to do it is what? He let them do it. And then that just continues. And we've seen that quite vividly over the last few weeks in the sermons. They bound him. What else did they do? Slapped him around, pounded him with fists. What?
Spit in his face.
Mocked him.
Flogged him
or scourged him. Tied him, up to a stone and beat his back to his ribbons. What?
His beard from his face.
Right? The crown of thorns, hitting the crown of thorns over the head, mocking him, and then finally, crucified him, nailed him to the cross. That, and of course, and here is where the irony from this perspective is, as all this is happening to him, the people who thought he was the Messiah, with each passing incident of him being bound and beaten and condemned and mocked and humiliated and then finally nailed and executed, what happened to their thought that he was the Messiah? It just disappeared. It just dissolved. Because you can't bound the hands of God. And you sure can't kill him. He's not the Messiah. So there is this. In John's gospel, even it's even more vividly seen that this is so strange that God is going through this. God the Son. But it's because he's allowing it. He is submitting himself to this experience in human flesh. Because John 1 also, again, that prologue is everything. That first chapter, that first half of that first chapter is everything to understand the Gospel of John. Yes, he is God the Son. He is, as we're told in John 1, in the beginning he was with God. In the beginning he was God. He is the life. He is the light. Okay? And he took flesh and dwelt among us. He pitched a tent in a human body and lived among us. And so in that tent, in that human body, he subjects himself to about the worst things that can happen to a human body. But he did not cease to be who he is, because everything from John 1 to John 18, he's been saying, I and the Father are one. You know, I came to do the will of the Father. I am of the Father. And what he means by that is not just he's a messenger, but he is the representation in every exact way of God. And this is what's happening to him. And when you look at sections like verses 19 to 23, let's read that section. 19 to 23. Can you read that, Rachel? John 18. This is before Annas.
The high priest therefore questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus answered him, I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. Behold, these I know what I said. And when he had said this, one of the officers standing by gave Jesus a blow, saying, Is this the way you answer the high priest? Jesus answered him, If I have spoken wrongly, bear witness of the wrong, but if rightly, why do you strike me?
Okay. Look at these two actions here. Verse 19, the high priest questioned Jesus. And then he gives his answer, and this officer strikes Jesus. He slaps Jesus. I think that's one of the occasions where he slapped. That's what the word means. The audacity of that. Knowing what we know from John's gospel, John 1 shows us who he really is in human flesh. We have this inside scoop. So it's like, do you not know who this is? Well, they don't. That the high priest is sitting there on his pompous kind of throne, not that he had a throne, but that's symbolic. And he's questioning Jesus. And then that this officer slaps Jesus. The audacity of this, but the audacity is coming from blind ignorance. We ought to be scared to death sometimes of our ignorance and our blindness. If on a regular basis, we're not concerned about what we're missing, we're probably missing a lot. Because these, if anything, these incidents show, they show so many things, but these incidents of these last chapters of the Gospels is that what humans are capable of regarding their audacity and their blind ignorance. And if we think we're not susceptible to that, then we're audaciously blind and ignorant. So we've got to be aware of what we may be blind to and embarrassed by our audacity because of that ignorance and checking that. Because this right here is an extreme example of that. None of us have all the answers. None of us have it all by the tail. And these men really thought, and doesn't their determination seem to just increase with each passing hour of these events from Thursday to Friday, that they're just more determined with each passing hour to do Jesus in, and they think they are so right in it. And they're not. They couldn't be more wrong than they were. And it's that Jesus allowed this to go on. It's just mind-boggling. It really is. Okay, before we leave chapter 18, anything? All right, let's look at 19. See some highlights here. So 19, Jesus has been prosecuted by Caiaphas in the Sanhedrin Council. He's gone to Pilate. Pilate is wrestling what to do with him. Sends him over to Herod for cross-examination. Herod sends him back with the declaration that he's innocent. Pilate, what does Pilate really want to do in this situation?
Let Jesus
go. Let him go. But the Jewish leadership and the masses that are whipped up by the Jewish leaders manipulate him and hem him up in a corner politically. And Pilate is squirming. The real person, in a way, on trial that day was Pilate in more ways than one. So this is when Pilate has already flogged Jesus. He's had him scourged, nearly beaten to death, thinking that would satisfy the Jewish cry to crucify him, and it does not. They still want him crucified. And Pilate is grappling with this, especially when he hears this right here. So look here at verses 7 through 11 of John 19. Ken, can you read that for us, John 19, 7 through 11?
The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to that law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered his headquarters and he said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. So Pilate said to him, You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have the authority to release you and the authority to crucify you?" Jesus said to him, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin."
Thank you. This is another one of those occasions that the irony surfaces here a little bit. And Jesus actually verbalizes this. Pilate thinks he's got the ultimate authority in this situation. That's why he's squirming, by the way. You know, people want authority. They really want authority and power. And then they get it. And they're like, uh-oh. This is hard. And he's got the authority, he thinks. But Jesus, and it's hard to know the inflections when you read these words on the page, but you can get the moment somewhat in these, especially these last chapters of the Gospels, that the emotional intensity is there on the page. You get it. But in almost like a Pecom-like fashion, while Pilate is pulling out the leverage of his authority, why aren't you talking to me? Jesus tells him what? Regarding authority. You're not the ultimate authority here. It's actually your position has been given to you. And that is, I mean, did Pilate ever have a prisoner ever like Jesus? Of course not. But there's that unusual kind of twist again. Jesus being bound, here he is before this man who claims to have authority when really this man has no authority in front of Jesus in a way. But what I want you to see out of this, and we pointed this out a couple weeks ago in the sermon, because this is sort of the climax of Jesus and Pilate's interaction. And that is the two questions that Pilate is confronted with here. When the crowd's trying to press him to kill Jesus, they pull out all kinds of stops. Ultimately, what they use are the political pressures on him about, you're no friend of Caesar's because he's claimed to be a king and all that. But they actually say in verse 7, he made himself to be the Son of God. And Pilate comes in and asks what?
Where are you from?
Where are you from?
Well, it seems like Pilate almost entertains that idea. He's willing to at least...
He's struggling with that, absolutely. Yeah.
They won't, but he says, wait a second here. That's what he says he became afraid.
He's struggling with this thing. And this, I think we pointed this out in the sermon. It's not like, hey, where are you from? Okay. The couple of you who are visiting this morning, I asked, where are you from? That's not the question. The question is, he's claiming to be the Son of God. Where are you from? Well, what has Jesus talked over and over in this gospel about? This is why I bring this up again. What has he talked about over and over in this gospel? His identity. And he constantly says things about where he's from. I came from the Father. I came from above. I'm not of this world. How many times does he say that in the Gospel of John? He says it over and over and over. And that's what Pilate has to grapple with here in the end. The thing that Jesus has been talking about all along. Is this an incredible piece of writing or not, how this is structured and how all these parts interact with each other and how this comes up. And it's not like the writing is made up to look like this. The events were unfolding this way. And John is capturing how all this unfolds and interconnects. It's so organic. And so Pilate is actually confronting the two big questions about Jesus. Is he the Son of God and where is he from? And that's it. I mean, that's the essence of the Gospel of John. Pilate is experiencing the message of the Gospel of John. And what's he going to do with it? In Pilate, we talked about the authorities that are prosecuting Jesus and how that humbles us to consider how we can be blind and arrogant. In so many ways, these characters around the cross become representative. And Pilate is representative. He reflects the human position when you're confronted with the identity of Jesus. Who is he? That's the universal, timeless question. Who is Jesus?
What are you going to do with
him? And then, what are you going to do with him? In light of that, and Pilate tries to avoid all that, doesn't he? And you know what Pilate does? Pilate does exactly what most human beings do. They dodge Jesus. Have you ever heard someone? I don't know. Maybe you have. Have you ever heard someone who said, yeah, that Jesus character, he was a fraud, and he was a manipulator and a deceiver and a troublemaker, and he's just, I don't know why anybody would want to follow after him. He's awful. You ever hear anybody say that? Even people who think that the Gospels are works of fiction, that they're products of Christians 3 centuries later, which, books like The Da Vinci Code advocates that position. That's a piece of fiction, but it actually reflects, like in some academic circles and other circles, what people really think, and that is Jesus was a real character. He's a nice guy, went around and taught some really neat things about loving your neighbor, but 200-300 years later, his followers concocted this image of him being the Son of God and walking on the water and healing the sick and raising the dead and all this. And it's just, he's a creation, okay? He's a piece of fiction. That's as bad as it gets with people's criticism of Jesus. People really still don't criticize Jesus. You know what they do? They avoid it. Oh, you follow Christ? Oh, that's good. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I'm interested. I'm not sure about some of that. I'm sure he was a good guy. They just want to push him away and keep going, which is exactly what Pilate wanted to do. Pilate is representative, like so many of these people are. So, all right, keep looking at chapter 19. Look down in verse 30. This is Jesus on the cross. And I want you to look at this in light of what we've been focusing on in the Gospel of John. Jesus is nearing the end of his time on the cross. And look at verse 30. Jane Lou, can you read verse 30 of John 19? Very simple there. What does it say?
So when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, "It is finished."
Keep going. There's a little bit left.
And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit.
I get what you did there. It's finished. It should be done. Okay, but a little bit more there. Okay. It's finished. Okay. So, and he gave up his spirit. Now, I want you to see two things in this verse. Jesus is aware of what's happening to his body. And we talked about in quite a bit of detail what physically happens in crucifixion, and that life just slowly ekes out and basically suffocation sets up this major organ failure and heart failure and everything like that, lack of oxygen. He's aware that the life is eking out of him. But there is more than just awareness. There's an action. He bowed his head and gave up his spirit. Just like he bowed his head, he bowed it. That's an active term. It's action. It's verb. And gave up his spirit. You could say of somebody who's dying, he just rolled over and died. Okay? And he died. That's an action. He just chose to die. We know a person doesn't do that. Death is happening to them. They are passive. In a way, all of us are killed, if you think about it. I mean, it's just terminology, but in a sense, all of us are killed. We don't choose to die unless you're committing suicide. It happens to us. I would have you see that's not the case here. His body has actually reached the point where it's exhausted of breath and life. But look what's also true about this moment of his death. He is an active participant. And this goes back, I don't have it up, John 10. Go back there with me, John 10, and look at what he says. Because we're to understand everything that's happening in light of what Jesus says about who he is. John chapter 10. And look what Jesus says about who he is and what he's capable of doing, what power he has. John 10. Frank, do you have that? Verse 17 and 18 of John 10.
Therefore, my Father loves me because I lay down my life that I may take it again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of myself. I have power to lay it down, and I have power to take it again. This command I have received from my Father.
All right, thank you. Let's look at the back end of this. What does Jesus mean when he says he has the power to take it up again? To what is he referring? His resurrection. What Jesus could predict when he would resurrect. Now, we also have seen, And this is the beauty of deity, that there are some texts that say that the Father raised the Son. There are texts that reference the Holy Spirit being involved in the resurrection of Jesus. But there are texts that also say, like this, that Christ would take up his life again. So we understand what he means by this. He will resurrect when he so chooses to resurrect. And according to this text, we also must conclude what?
He's
going to die when he chooses to die. Remember how Jesus would be in certain stressful moments and he would say, "My time is not yet." Or he would slip out from a crowd that was getting out of hand and slip away from them. This thing didn't go down until it was just the right time when Jesus wanted it to go down regarding his arrest and trial and death and all this. And it doesn't mean that he didn't fully experience death. He was experiencing life eke out of his body in the full human sense. But at the same time, again, hold on to your brains. Don't let it blow out of your head. That's what this gospel does to you. Blow your head plumb off trying to comprehend this. What his physical body is going through, the typical things that a body would go through under such trauma and abuse and attack and all this that he's going through, at the same time, he is in control of life and death.
Well, he had power to heal people. He had power to raise the dead. Why couldn't he have prolonged his life on the cross?
He could have, exactly. He could have stopped the bleeding. He could have slowed down the bleeding. He could have done something to increase his lung capacity to get more air, all those kinds of things. He doesn't. He experiences it fully as a human body would experience it. But he is subjecting himself to it. And isn't he referring to that in that conversation with Pilate, in that this is all happening because this is the Father's will and this is my will? It's not you. It's not even Caiaphas. If you're going to look for an authority that's the most guilty, it's not Pilate, it's Caiaphas. He is that nasty political animal that's pulling the strings and working the Sanhedrin and manipulating his fellow leaders and then ultimately the people and putting the screws, screwing the screws down tighter and tighter and more fierce, like he's in a vice to Pilate. That's what Caiaphas is doing. This was not Caiaphas' doing.
Well, that's why Jesus said, "He who delivered you up to me has the greater sin."
That's right. Caiaphas is who he's talking about there. He's talking about the Jewish leadership. Absolutely. But even Caiaphas is not in control of this. God is. Yeah, Glenn?
Maybe this is the epitome of the word sacrifice. And if we are to be like Jesus, I think we fall very short of being sacrificial to those whom we love, even just in general. I think we have a lot to learn.
There's no sacrifice in experiencing something you have no control over. The real sacrifice is when you have control over it and you give in to the sacrifice. You make the sacrifice. Jesus, prime example.
The word that keeps screaming in my head throughout this entire class that I think defines this is the word authority. I mean, Matthew 28, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. What Pilate's dealing with is, where are you from? If he accepts Jesus to be who he says he is, he has to yield to his authority. Just like you and I do, just like the Gnostics had to, that John writes to in other places. It's really man's put in a position to accept the word of Jesus that defines authority. And once authority has been defined, all of the other things, the miraculous things that we're seeing, fall under that knowledge and that understanding. And I think that's the thing that we struggle with the most, is accepting the fact that this is the definition of authority, to take his life up, right, to extend it, to have it happen at the right time. I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. That's an authoritative statement that we have to see. And that's when men start getting themselves in harm's way. This ignorance we're talking about and blindness is part of that. We are ignorant and blind because we don't want to accept the authority. And we leave ourselves in that darkness. Once we've been shown the light, and we allow it to not establish that authority in our own hearts, we will stay ignorant and blind by choice or avoid it, like you said.
And isn't it so remarkable that these things are happening to Jesus, that he's allowing to happen to him. These are his credentials as to why he has authority over us. Yeah, he has authority as the creator to command anything of us. But he's looking for people who willingly submit to that authority. And these are the prime credentials. Look what he did and what he suffered for us. He wants us to do what he tells us to do. And he's the only one who could claim that kind of authority over us because of what he did. Look at the resurrection scene with Mary Magdalene. This is after the women come to the tomb. Peter and John come and look. They can't figure out what's happened. Most of them believe, when the tomb's empty, most of them believe what initially? Somebody's taking the body. And this is when Jesus appears to Mary outside the tomb when she is distraught. And so look at this here. Hilton, can you read verse 15 to 18 of John 20? John 20, 15 to 18, please.
He said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you seeking?" She, supposing him to be the gardener, said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him, "Rabbon," which is teacher. Jesus said to her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God." One more?
No, that's good. Yeah, thank you. That's good. 17 is good. Remember one of the things that we've seen in the last few weeks after the establishment of this relationship of the Father and the Son that's so vividly revealed in the gospel, this beautiful, powerful relationship, that when Jesus, especially the night he was betrayed, he's talking with the apostles, and he's talking to them not just about him and them, but also those who would believe on him through their work. He's talking about future believers. Remember how we said that this relationship shared by the Father and Son expanded and is offered to believers? Well, look at this dialogue between Mary and Jesus. Note the language Jesus uses. First of all, the language he uses here, what does it reflect about his relationship with the Father? What does he call the Father?
Father and your Father.
Right, God, and my God and your God. In a sense, the Father was his Father, but also the Father was God to him. Okay, hang on to your brains. I know they want to just blow out of your head. But it's true. It's what it says. It says what it says here. But he also says his Father was also what? Your Father. To Mary. Is there a more loyal disciple in these last moments, these last few days, than Mary Magdalene? She's right there. She's right there when it counts, right? At the cross and at the tomb. In this moment, she's Peter. She's the rock. It's Mary Magdalene. And no wonder, when you really understand her role in these things, I wonder all these tales are spun about her centuries later. You hear all these things about Mary Magdalene in popular culture. None of it's true. That she was a prostitute and then some really crazy things. Her and Jesus had a romance and just crazy stuff. But I tell you what it's born out of. It's born out of this incredible role she has here in the biblical text. And then it just churns people up to want to make up more things about her. But he says, He's my Father and your Father. He's my God and your God. And then when she tells him to go announce about his resurrection, who is she to announce it to? Go tell who? What does it say in the text? Verse 17. Go tell my brothers. Yeah, there are other occasions when they're told to go tell the disciples, go tell Peter. Yeah, that's in other texts. In this Mary Magdalene conversation, that's with the other women. With the Mary Magdalene conversation, he says, go tell my brothers. My brothers. You're in the family. Jesus, on every page, multiple times, is talking about my father, my father, my father, my father, my father. All through the Gospel of John, now he says, your father too. Because we're all brothers. See that invitation into that divine family?
Our elder brother?
Yeah, well, joint heir. He's called a joint heir. Yeah. So this is just, this conversation is showing that there. It's showing that it's ending, this gospel is ending on this invitation to come into this family and be God's child. Exactly. Well, there's some other highlights, but we're out of time. So I've enjoyed this study with you. Hopefully it's motivated you to want to look more closely at the Gospel of John. Thank you.